From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. Today we're speaking live from the University of International Relations here in Beijing. I'm with Dr. Da Wei, Assistant President and Professor here at the University. Da Wei was formerly with the China Institute for Contemporary International Relations, otherwise known as KICR, and served as the Director for the Institute of American Studies. During such a critical time in the U.S.-China relationship, we here at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center are going to try to make an effort to speak more often with leading Chinese scholars about U.S.-China relations. We're going to aim for about once a week. And to start that process, we're going to talk. I can't think of anyone better, frankly, to start that process than with Da Wei, who is one of China's top scholars on U.S.-China relations and American and Chinese foreign policy, a name very familiar to anyone in the United States that studies U.S.-China relations. Da Wei, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Paul, for having me. It's my great honor.
So let's get right to the issues. We're speaking 1 week after Vice President Mike Pence gave a speech at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. He, in his speech, forcefully criticized a range of Chinese behavior. He talked about unfair trade practices, aggressive military posturing by China, even political interference in the U.S. elections. I have my own views on these, but I want to start out by asking you, what was your reaction to the speech?
I think, like many Chinese scholars, I view this speech very seriously. Actually, I watched his speech lively during the National Day holiday, like many other scholars, and we treated it very seriously. And generally,
even though it was a holiday, you
live. Yes. And I think my response is, I think this is a very serious speech, and it's very harsh to China. And I feel there are many many comments that I don't agree with, but people discuss this speech very heatedly. So many people view it as a new Fulton speech, which was made by Winston Churchill,
declared Iron Curtain speech.
Yes. So I attended several meetings after that. Everybody are talking about is that speech, it's like a new Cold War, starting off the new Cold War. So people are asking this question. I think first of all, this is an important speech because this is a speech made by the Vice President of the
Sure.
United States. And it's a speech for China policy. This is the first time we heard a senior U.S. official deliver a China policy speech. So, of course, we take it very seriously. But secondly, we don't know. I think we still lack many details of this speech. Why did he make this speech? And does that represent the whole administration's viewpoints towards China? And who wrote the speech for him?
Mm-hmm.
So we lack the details of this speech. Thirdly, I think we think that speech represents the mainstream view of feeling in the U.S. towards China, this kind of frustration, anxiety, or maybe anger towards China. So there are many, many, like you said, criticism mm-hmm. About China.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think I have not heard any concrete thing for the next step. We don't know what is the policy.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of complaints, there are a lot of criticism, but there's no strategy, there's no action, what will the U.S. do next 40 years or 30 years, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And basically, it declared the end of the engagement strategy, but we don't know what is the new strategy. Mm. And of course, the fourthly or the last point is, as I said at the beginning, I don't agree with many of the criticism in the speech from his description of the history of U.S.-China relations, about the open door policy to China, and to the newest, blame, like what you said, like the China's so-called interference into the U.S. domestic politics. Mm. I think many of them lack of evidence, groundless criticism, and serves, I said, personally, serves the domestic political need of the Trump administration.
Thank you for that. You know, it's interesting. My own reaction was that the speech did address and outline in a fairly comprehensive way a number of challenges and areas of disagreement and areas of confrontation where we have with China. When I served in the Bush administration, many of the issues that he referred to were also on the agenda, and even into the Obama administration. China now is a stronger country, it's more powerful, and it's more influential, and its presence is felt much more than it was even just 10 years ago. Mm. So those challenges that we faced in the Obama administration, the Bush administration, left unresolved, I think they continue to grow. And I agree with you, the speech, the tone of the speech, whereas in the past you might have a speech that addressed some of the differences and some of the challenges, but it was balanced with areas where the United States wants to enhance cooperation on common interests. And that's not where the emphasis was on this speech. It really was on those areas where we have challenges. Mm-hmm. I will say, as an American, many of the challenges he described resonated with me. I understood what he was talking about. And as somebody who cares about the U.S.-China relationship, I think we need to address those in order to make sure that we don't enter a Cold War, strictly confrontational period. So I give Vice President Pence some credit for raising those issues. Mm-hmm. It's important in any bilateral relationship, especially one as consequential as the U.S.-China one, to be honest about the challenges in front of us. And, you know, the national security strategy and the national defense strategy has said China is a strategic competitor. I personally don't think that has to be seen so much as a negative. We can compete, it seems to me. The question is, what kind of competition is it going to be? Can we compete in a healthy way? Or is it, going to be more confrontational? Matt Pottinger, Senior Director for Asia at the National Security Council, delivered remarks at the Chinese embassy where he said, with the Chinese ambassador, Ambassador Cui Tiankai, where he said, the U.S. had updated its China policy to bring the concept of competition to the forefront. Mm-hmm. And indeed, that appears to be the growing consensus among many U.S. experts, not just Trump officials, but other Republicans and, I would say, even Democrats. How do you think China interprets statements like Pottinger's? Do they see it as negative, as confrontational? Or is there a way that the U.S. and China can compete in a more healthy way?
I think comparing with Vice President Pence's speech, Mr. Pottinger's speech, for the people like me, sounds more, balanced and I won't say friendly, but balanced, I will say. For us, that we can understand the competition is not necessarily a bad thing. Both U.S. and China, I think we are two countries very good at competition, and we all live in competition. Our companies, our business community compete every day. So for me and for the scholars and many officials, I think they can understand this, and they don't necessarily view this from a very negative way. But As I said, you know, in other occasion, I think in China, in Chinese, competition, you know, when you say 竞争 in Chinese, competition, it's not very constructive. This is a culture thing, you know. For Chinese, we do competition, but we don't always put the word competition by our, you know, on our mouth. Yeah, we don't say it publicly every day. Although, of course, our companies compete to each other too. So this is differences between the foreign policy elites and the ordinary audience. And another thing is, even for me, I think competition between China and the U.S. is okay. But as you said, what you said is very important. We need a healthy competition. And in what a kind of environment, atmosphere, are we going to compete? I think if we combine Mr. Pottinger's speech and the Vice President Pence's speech together, it's not a very healthy environment for the two countries to compete. Or like Japan and the U.S. have competition, right? The Europe and the U.S. have competition. But the U.S. has also kind of competition with Soviet Union. What kind of competition does the American side want? And from the speech of Vice President Pence and from the several documents released from the end of last year, the feeling here, or the message we got here, is U.S. is going to view China as a rival, even enemy like Soviet Union, and compete with China, compete, you know, on the ideology, on the geopolitics, on economy, high tech, you know, high technology. I think this is a, you know, comprehensive competition, and a competition with a rival or even an enemy. So this kind of competition, it's true, it's a competition, but this kind of competition is, I will say, it's dangerous. We are facing this danger, step into a situation that neither the U.S. nor China want.
One of the things I think that's really driving the tone of the relationship and the dynamics that you describe is the current tensions on the trade and economics.
Yes.
Many in the United States, many Americans, including myself, are very quick to criticize President Trump, his focus on the trade deficit as kind of the key metric for thinking about the U.S.-China bilateral economic and trade relationship. Many people think that's misguided and openly criticize the president for that. And his use of tariffs as a tool. Both Republicans and Democrats are very critical of the president. But there is bipartisan support in the United States on the issue of the need to get tougher with China to recalibrate the economic and trade relationship. The idea that after China joined the WTO in 2001 and received preferential treatment, you know, as a real developing country 17 years ago, but made commitments that it would open up, that it would open markets, that it would improve its intellectual property, that it would address issues of state subsidies to Chinese private companies, a number of issues where not just the United States, but our friends in Europe and Asia all had expectations that China would do that, and that we haven't seen that done. And so, you know, I often say that on foreign policy and trade policy, the Democrats don't agree much with the Trump administration, but even Senator Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, violent agreement with the Trump administration, we need to be tougher on China. Here in China, I've seen a couple narratives about what's happening here. One narrative is that I hear from Chinese senior officials and experts is that this is all about Trump's short-term political imperatives. This was especially the case a year ago in the spring, that he was looking to get some victory that he could tweet out to his base in advance of the midterms. That narrative has now shifted to the other end of the spectrum, that it's all about strategic containment, that the U.S. wants to block China's legitimate rise. it seems to be void, that both narratives, of any reflection of what role China may have played in getting to the point where we're at today, either policies that China pursued, or maybe more importantly, policies that China didn't pursue along reform and opening up. Mm-hmm. What, if any, kind of discussions are taking place in China, among Chinese, about what China might be able to do to begin to bring more stability, to begin to recalibrate? Mm-hmm. Are there voices that say, hey, you know what? We, China, hasn't really undergone the kind of reform we indicated we would, and the United States, our friends in Europe, our friends in Asia, are not happy. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of discussion taking place? Because it's hard to see from the outside.
I think this year, 2018, marks the 40th anniversary of China's reform and opening up.
Yes.
Of course, it's also 40th anniversary of the normalization of our China and the U.S. diplomatic relations.
Yeah.
January the 1st, right?
Right, 40th years of U.S. China relations. Yeah.
So this 240th anniversary happened very, you know, will happen this year. And we have the problem on China-U.S. relations, on trade friction, on economic friction. And this kind of pressure really, as you said, as you asked, has already pushed many Chinese to ask, are all these complaints, wrong? Maybe is there something that we need to study? We need to do more. I think people here asking ourselves, as I said, this is the 40th anniversary of opening up and reform. So do we need to maybe accelerate our reform and opening up at this critical junction? I think the answer is. Is we have some kind of consensus, at least among the scholars, that China need more reforms and China need to march rapidly towards the direction of market economy and open society and also open economy. I think there are a lot of heated discussion here in China on this, and also the mainstream view is more reform and more opening up. And we hope that by this chance to commemorate the 40th anniversary of reform and opening up, we can do more, we can push the country to do more. But the problem here is, as we want to do more, but now the U.S., the Trump administration gave China very heavy pressure. So they press China to do more. Mm-hmm. And I totally understand those complaints from the American side, though I don't necessarily agree with all the complaints, but I totally understand why they have this complaint. But, you live in China for a very long time. You know China very well. And if you know China very well, have you ever seen Chinese government do this kind of major reform under the foreign pressure? I think no. My answer is no.
So you raise a very good point. And I think, I've given advice on the U.S. side that we need to be attuned to the fact that the Chinese leadership here cannot be perceived by the Chinese public as caving to pressure by Donald Trump. Just as much as Donald Trump would not want to be appearing to cave into Chinese pressure in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We both have our own domestic politics. And so I think, yes, a more sophisticated approach by the U.S. is warranted. I would argue on the U.S. side that they would do themselves a great service if they were to broaden it out to include our international partners. Mm-hmm. It'd be harder for China than to say it's all about U.S. wanting to contain China, because the issues really that are important are areas where we have common concern with our friends in Europe and Asia. And if we kind of join together, it'd be harder for China to say this is all about containment. You'd have to say the entire international community is trying to contain China. At the same time, I think your criticism is right. However, I would add, though, that I served in the White House. It's hard to create a narrative in the United States that people buy into, because you have a lot of different voices. But in China, you have a one-party system, and much more control of the media. There is a narrative that can be grabbed onto by the leadership to say, we're making these reforms because it's, as you say, the 40th anniversary of reform and opening up, because we announced in 2013 at the third plenum this very ambitious economic reform plan. This is in China's interest. We're going to do this. We're going to do it more aggressively. We're going to pick up the pace and the scope. And we're doing it for Chinese reasons, for Chinese interest. And at the same time, many of those reforms align with what the international community is hoping China will do. So I think there's a way that China can do it by tying it to China's own interests, it seems to me. Now, I've asked, here's a question for you. I've asked Chinese scholars if that's something that the Chinese leadership could do. And sometimes I get very candidly back, yes, they could, but we're not convinced the Chinese leadership still agrees or is committed to the reforms that were announced in 2013. Is what's your understanding of that? It's a big question that Americans and others around the world are interested in. When they saw the ambitious economic reform plan put out in 2013, a year after Xi Jinping had been elevated to the leadership in China, the international community was quite impressed.
I think there are two kinds of issues that are being discussed between the U.S. and China over China's reform. One is issues are like lower the tariff, like open more economic section, and protect the intellectual property. I think this kind of thing is, I think very clearly, Chinese government want to do it better.
Opening markets as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The only thing is, doing it in China is not as easily as 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's very, very complicated. I heard a story from some Chinese official. They told me that how hard they, you know, when they try to push even some simple action, you know, because it's related to different, to the interest of different people and different provinces, different ministries, so it's not easy.
So even when the national level says, yes, we're going to move in this direction,
it's
vested interests cling to their...
And there are also another basket of, you know, issues, like the role of the SOEs, for example, to be frank, like... the role of the government and the party in the economic activity.
Absolutely.
I think this is a very profound dispute, or maybe not the profound question issue between China and the U.S.
Exactly.
For that basket, I don't think China wants to do a lot, because this is related to China's basic economic and political system. And I don't think Chinese government want to give it up. While the U.S. side and maybe other countries, the Western world, won't be satisfied if China does not reform that basket. But my personal view is, you know, this is China's basic system. So,
but it is, but it isn't. I mean, in 2013, the economic reform plan that was announced said, and it was a major shift, that that China would rely on market forces,
yes,
in terms of allocating resources that would play the decisive role. And I think what's interesting is, you know, America saw that change. The international community saw that change. Mm-hmm. And I know there were huge supporters here in China. But it seems that since then, that's not the direction that China has gone down. So was there a change in the thinking from 2013 to now?
I don't think so. I think, you know, even as if we go back to the third plenum, as you mentioned, to let the market to play the decisive role does not mean we need to reduce the role of the SOEs, for example. The SOE can also still play a very important role following the market economy principle. I think this is what we believe, our Chinese government believe here. And also the party can still play a role in the, you know, operating of a company as the company follows the market economy's principle. So we don't think, or the Chinese government don't think this is contradictory to each other. But I understand, yeah, from the foreigner's perspective, this is, you know, this is not the correct direction. They don't agree with that. So these are the issues that I said that probably we cannot solve in at next phase.
The other issue that's related to that, of course, is around Made in China 2025, the areas of technology, frontier technology, that many say will determine the future in terms of our competition. And I think, you know, I often hear Chinese friends here say, you know, we can develop our own technology base. You cannot stop us from doing that. And I think that's not actually what the American side is saying. I think what they're saying is we're willing to compete. We know competition. Our system in the United States is based on competitive forces, and we all participate in that, you know, with pleasure. But we want to be able to compete from a level playing field. And when the Chinese government is in a position to provide huge subsidies to Chinese companies that then go out and build up a track record of success in China and then go abroad, many in the international community, especially in Europe, I hear this argument from our European friends all the time, that this will not allow their companies, other international companies, to compete at a level playing field. And, you know, it's not that the international community is trying to stop China from developing its technological base. You can't stop a country from wanting to do that. Every country has a right to do that. It's just how it's done.
Yes.
And what I hear you saying is that also, given that it's about the role of the state, that may not be an issue that we can address. And I think that would be a big area of friction going forward.
I think, you know, even in that regard, the state, the country can play, the government can play a role, like making the industry policy, like invest more money into R&D. I think those are the role that the government can play.
We've done that in the United States.
Yes, exactly. And I totally agree with you. The problem is not the Made in China 2025. The problem is how to implement the Made in China 2025. But I think now the problem on the US side is your side has not present this question very accurately. We, from different people, we heard different complaints, but the general perception or the impression here is the US government does not want the Made in China 2025 because that will make China surpass the US in the future in the key industries. So that being that kind of objection has been translated or interpreted as the US does not want China to surpass the US. The US want to keep China down. So it becomes a political issue.
Yeah, my own sense is that Made in China 2025 gave the international community, not just the United States, but the international community, the impression that China wanted to take the commanding heights in these frontier technologies, mm-hmm. but using a means where there's huge state support, which seems to not allow for other international companies to compete fairly. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I think the United States, Europe, other countries in Asia who have real concerns here need to articulate them in a way that doesn't convey this sense that we're trying to prevent China from competing with us. Because as I said, China has a right, just like every other country in the world, to compete. It's the question is, how are we going to compete?
And actually, in China, there are also many people argue that the too big role of the government may damage the innovation, because many people here believe that the real innovation should be made by the business community, by particularly by the private, you know, companies, rather than you know, pushed by the government. And so here is a very popular view in China, said that every time when government want to invest a lot of money and support push for one industry, it will fail. those really creative part of China's economy are the private part rather than the state-owned part. So I think we don't have that so big differences in this regard on this issue, but this issue has been politicized now.
Yeah, and my understanding when I talk to Chinese friends in the government and other experts, they say you notice now that China is not talking about Made in China 2025, which, you know, in my own view, to me, it's really not about whether you talk about it or don't talk about it. It's not about whether China has aspirations for moving up the value chain in these fields. I think that's every country has those aspirations. The question is how you do it. And I think we need to have some meeting of the minds. Again, it's not just U.S. China. And I think that's important because it seems to me in China, whenever it gets into that U.S. China channel only, then people think here in China, oh, the U.S. is trying to block China's rise, contain China. It needs to be broadened out because the international community has concerns, and you know, German leaders, leaders in the UK have been talking about these issues as well. Finally, on the trade and economic issues, my concern is if we continue down this path where, you know, President Trump announces another $200 billion, 10% now, but 25% January 1st. He says he's willing to follow up with another $200 billion plus. Mm-hmm. If we keep going tit for tat, this will affect the broader relationship, and those dynamics we talked about around Vice President Pence's speech will get worse. I think we need some progress on the trade and economic issues. We need to show that we're going to shift this into a more constructive direction. Mm-hmm. How do we do that?
I think because we don't have a lot of effective communication channel now, all of the dialogues almost all of them has been cut. So now I think we rely on the two leaders very much, two presidents very much. And I don't know if they are going to, the media yesterday announced that they are going to meet
at the G20.
Right. Yeah, I hope that the two countries can reach a kind of agreement on this meeting, on this summit on G20. I totally agree with you that we need to show some progress to stop the current trajectory. Probably the G20 is the only chance that I can see now. If we cannot achieve that, then I don't know when can we. Maybe we need more times to wait for that. That will be very dangerous.
Would it be helpful from your perspective for the Chinese leadership to do something that indicates their recognition that this is not about containment.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about the U.S. or other countries trying to block China's rise. That there are legitimate issues here, as you said, around market access and intellectual property and, you know, technology transfer. That some acknowledgement to the international community that, you know, I heard one former U.S. trade representative who worked on Asia and Bush and Obama say to me, China champions itself as a defender of the global and an active supporter and contributor to the global economic and trading system. But if every country operated its economy like China, the global economic and trading system would implode.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that China can acknowledge? Because I think that would go such a long way to say, look, we get it. There are issues that we, China, this is not about all... This is not about the United States treating us unfairly or moving to containment. There are real legitimate issues here that need to be addressed, and China has a huge role in doing that. Is there a way to do that at this point? Because I think that would go a long way.
I think probably if the two presidents meet at G20, this is a message that China can send to President Trump, you know, face to face. I think that, and of course, then publicly, I think that will be a proper venue. And at the same time, I also hope the U.S. side can send a clear message to China
We're not trying to keep you down.
Yes, we don't want to keep you down. We welcome.
We're not trying to block your legitimate rise.
Like the previous administration, Obama administration say we welcome the rise of China. We want to,
That's an important message for the U.S. to send.
But we have not heard the message from the U.S. so far. And also we want a unified administration from the American side. And we want a clear message. People here still are asking very basic question. Is the Trump administration want to strike a deal with China or are they going to keep China down? So this, we don't know that. And we don't know who is the, reliable interlocutor in the Trump administration. If mm-hmm. If we talk to this secretary, then when he back to the DC, then the agreement being denied by the president.
This is Lioja's deal.
Yeah, I think this make China feel very difficult to make any meaningful negotiation with the U.S. side. Some people maybe say, if I made this concession to the U.S. side, then maybe 3 or 6 months later, the Trump administration may change its idea, say that's not enough. Though half a year ago, it's okay, but now it's not okay.
So your points are very important, Dawei. Number one, that diplomacy is important in
this.
Yes,
sure.
And that there need to be private discussions held between the senior leaders.
Mm-hmm.
We often say in the United States, the real decision maker in all of this is Trump. And I think the same can be said here in China. Real decision maker is President Xi. But your other point is interesting. There are things that China needs to hear from the United States. This is not about strategic containment.
Yeah.
We do want to reach a deal of sorts. My own view is, because we're talking about these structural issues, it's not a one-time deal and then move on. This is something, it's, I think, a deal up front that shows real progress, and then the announcement of a process that over time we can address these issues. But also that China, in that context, that there are signals that China needs to send, i.e. we acknowledge that we have responsibility in this and we have a role in this. There's things we need to do as well to get us out of this predicament and move to a more stable situation. I think those are very, very important.
I think China side can say something like, the U.S. always criticized, for example, on tariff issue, China's tariff, of course, is higher than the U.S. But we think that we have already delivered our promise to the when we enter the WTO. So that's okay. Yeah, probably that's true. Yeah, but China side can say that now China is China is not a developed country, but China is much more well off than 17 years ago. We can promise more.
Yeah,
we are willing. We are willing to do more reform. We are willing to lower our tariff and import more goods from the U.S. I think this kind of thing. I mean, the U.S. side basically say we welcome China's rise so long as you follow a kind of economic model or the way you operate your economy. Well, China side say we are willing to do more reform, and we'll consider your complaint. We are willing to solve the complaints that you have, but you should not contain me. Yeah, let's then we can have a healthy competition.
Well, Dawei, there's so much more we could talk about, but unfortunately, I know you've got a busy schedule. You've got to teach students here at the University of International Relations. We've talked about a lot. I think we've talked about some very important issues. And I want to thank you very much for your candor and your willingness to talk to us on China and the world.
Thank you very much for having me. This is really a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China and the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.